So they'll still be instanton solutions that interpolate between neighboring vacuum. And but the difference is, yesterday when we were considering multi-instanton solutions, we had to alternate instantons and anti-instantons because there were only two vacuum states and or approximate vacuum states. So if we tunneled to the right, we'd have to tunnel back to the left to get to another vacuum. Here we can keep tunneling to the right or left as much as we like, and we can our multi-instanton solutions, we can stitch together instantons and anti-instantons in any order we like. But apart from that difference, this problem is essentially the same problem we studied yesterday. But the fact that we can put the instantons and anti-instantons in any order has changes the physics a bit. So remember what we were doing yesterday was computing the propagators by doing a saddle point approximation to the path integral. And if we want to compute the amplitude for a particle to propagate from x equals k to x equals l, what we'll get, we saw what we got yesterday, was some normalization, which I claimed was this. And then we had to sum over all of the saddle points, which were the one instanton and multi-instanton solutions. And so we had restrictions on the number of instantons and anti-instantons we were allowed to have before. Here, the restriction is a bit different. So we can have any number of instantons. So let's say we have n instantons and n bar anti-instantons. So we can have any number of instantons and any number of anti-instantons. And for every instanton or anti-instanton, we'll get a factor of k. This was from our determinant. So that accounts for the fluctuations around each of the instantons. Also get a t that comes from the zero mode. So we can have these instanton or anti-instanton centered anywhere we like, times e to the minus s naught, which was the action of the one instanton solution over h bar. So we get one factor for each, like this, for each instanton or anti-instanton. And then we also have, well, we can't have any possible number of instantons or anti-instantons. We need to get from x equals k to x equals l. Instantons will move us to the right, anti-instantons move us to the left. So we need the total number of instantons minus the number of anti-instantons to be l minus k.
What is the stuff on the first slide?
This is the normalization constant. This is what I called C yesterday. Okay. I didn't compute it, but I argued that, well, I made a few statements. I didn't really argue, but that you have to get this time dependence comes from requiring that the normalization is independent of the potential. This is conventional. This factor will come out like this if we assume that near each of the minima, the potential is quadratic. So it's that assumption, those assumptions go into this normalization. Okay, so this formula is quite similar to what we did yesterday. But this is going to tell us the ground state energy will be different than yesterday. And to see that, We can use the identity that delta AB is the integral from 0 to 2 pi theta over 2 pi e to the minus I theta A minus B. And using that, we can break these sums up into two independent sums. So our amplitude will become, still have our normalization constant C. And then we have integral d theta minus I theta k minus L for sums over the number of instantons and anti-instantons, kt e to the minus s naught h bar n plus n bar e to the I theta n minus n bar. And now these sums are independent. We've got a product of something involves n with something involves n bar. So we can do the sums. And if we do the sums, what we'll get is the exponential 2kt cosine of theta e to the minus s naught for h bar. And so if we want to get the energy, we need to take the t goes to infinity limit of h bar over t times the log of this amplitude. And so what we'll find then, we do that, is that the energy is continuous. So we have a continuum of energy eigenstates, which are, and the energy will depend on this parameter theta. So there's a continuum of approximately degenerate. This is still exponentially small energy eigenstates. And we'll see the same thing when we discuss gauge theory tomorrow.
When do you get an energy, would you balance it up?
Which depends on theta. So if we're computing, so what we want to do is basically take the log of this divided by t and send t to infinity. So this this over t is going to be the instanton contribution. So over here, well, so this potential has not just a discrete spectrum, but there's a continuous spectrum.
And the L, I don't understand the link between the energy and the L and J. Like, how does the initial?
So our formula for the energy was that the energy was minus the limit c goes to infinity h bar over t log of z, where this is z. Maybe the sign is wrong.
But you said it depends on L and K, like the initial and final forms. That's what I don't understand. Like how the energy depends on the initial and final forms.
How it.
Like what does that mean physically, basically?
What is this? So this term is not going to be important once we take the t goes to infinity.
K and L are not important for the energy.
Right. We could get the same result for the energy no matter what choices we made for K and L. We're integrating over theta.
What is e theta?
How do you get from the theta?
How do you get e from e theta? Or like how do you
So here, if we do this limit, we still have this integral. So before there was a gap between our lowest energy state and then the next energy state. Here they're continuously connected, and this integral over theta respects indicates that. So our energy is going to depend on theta. So when we take the log, compute this log, it will depend on.
After the integration, theta should disappear.
What's the definition of e theta? Like, how did you
get that? So that's just this. Using this identity, it's just a parameter.
Yeah, but like, what is like if I tried to calculate that? What is the definition of e theta to do that? I guess.
So if we had a discrete set of states, we could look at the term that goes to zero, the second slowest, and that would tell us about the first excited state. So here we've got term that goes to zero. The lowest energy state would be when cosine of theta is minus one, but there's no gap between that state and the next state. We could write, in the case where we had a gap, we could write it as a sum and consider the subleading correction to this formula. So here there's no gap, and the sum would become an integral.
And so you do not perform the integral, right?
Right.
It's like integration over e theta d theta?
Right. Okay. So the next case I want to consider. Is metastable potential. And so I have in mind a one-dimensional quantum mechanical problem where the potential looks something like this. Assume there's a metastable vacuum with zero potential and that state that's localized here would eventually tunnel through the barrier. And so if we wanted to solve the Euclidean equations of motion, that's equivalent to solving the same problem with an inverted potential. And so what we're looking for are solutions to Euclidean equations of motion in this potential. And the path integral we'll want to consider in this case, let's call this point here xi, and this point here x star. The propagator we'll want to compute will be the propagator from xi to xi. And so that means the boundary conditions we'll want to impose are that the particle starts at xi and ends at xi. And so there'll be solutions to the Euclidean equation of motion with zero energy that start and end at xi. So there's a trivial solution. So where the solution just sits at xi for all time, that's a trivial solution. We define instantons to be solutions that are non-trivial. but there'll be a non-trivial solution that starts at xi, rolls over to x star, and rolls back. So it will look something like this. And this an instanton solution, it's sometimes also called a bounce solution, because the particle goes to xi and bounces back. So we've imposed, we need to impose slightly different boundary conditions if we want to get a non-trivial solution to the Euclidean equations of motion in this case. But otherwise, the analysis basically works as before, with the difference that k will be purely imaginary. And that's because there'll be exactly one negative eigenvalue. Of s double prime. And well, there's still going to be a zero eigenvalue coming from the fact that this bounce solution can be centered anywhere. And you can show that the eigenfunction associated with that eigenvalue has exactly one node. So there has to be a eigenfunction with a lower eigenvalue. And well, the fact that k is purely imaginary is exactly what we'd expect, or at least it has an imaginary part, because for a resonant state, we can relate the decay rate to the imaginary part of the energy. And so if we do the same thing as before, sum over any number of bounces, the result will be that the decay rate is the absolute value of k e to the minus se of this bound solution over h bar. So the same. So basically, just do the same procedure, and we'll get this result. And so the procedures we've been using to calculate energy differences and decay rates in quantum mechanics generalize almost immediately to quantum field theory. And that's because well, we only looked at one-dimensional quantum mechanics, but we can imagine what would change if we looked at multidimensional quantum mechanics. So if we were analyzing a quantum mechanics in more than one dimension, all of the arguments I made basically didn't depend on the dimension. We were looking for saddle points of the path integral. We'd still want to do that. So that was our basic technique. So we're looking for saddle points. We'd still want to look for saddle points if we were in more than one dimension. The only possible difference is maybe the boundary conditions will change a little bit, but if we're in more than one dimension, we can impose more boundary conditions. But apart from that, we could apply these same techniques, quantum mechanics, in more than one dimension, and quantum field theory can think of as an infinite dimensional limit of quantum mechanics. So the same techniques of finding the saddle points of the functional integral will work in quantum field theory, just like they do in quantum mechanics. So we'll look at one application. of these ideas to quantum field theory, and that is the decay of the false vacuum in scalar quantum field theory. And so the problem I have in mind here is we'll assume that our Euclidean action is just the integral of, we're in scalar field theory and we'll assume a canonical kinetic term and with some interaction term, which I'll call u, some function of phi. And the situation I have in mind is that the potential has multiple minima and they're non-degenerate. And let's suppose that the minima are located at phi f and phi t. I'll assume that u of phi f is 0 and that u of phi t is negative. So the situation we're going to look at is we can imagine that we set up some initial conditions where the field is homogeneous and in the false vacuum. So, and we're going to look at the quantum mechanical nucleation of a bubble inside of which the field is close to phi t. So if we started with a vacuum state with field expectation value, the field is phi f, that would be unstable, and it would be unstable to nucleation of a bubble inside of which the field took values near phi t. So our previous analysis carries over with just a few changes, although the physical interpretation is going to be different in several ways. So our previous analysis tells us that the decay rate per unit volume should look something like this. So here, A is a prefactor that includes the normalization and the determinant. Your phi is going to be a bounce solution, like the one we just sketched in the unstable potential. And the relevant thing to compute is not the decay rate, but the decay rate per unit volume. So we're asking, the question we're asking is what's the rate of nucleation of a bubble, which is a localized object. And clearly our answer should be different depending on if we're asking if the bubble is going to be located somewhere in the observable universe or somewhere in this room. The bigger the volume we consider, the larger the probability per unit time that a bubble should nucleate. So expect that this is the quantity to compute. And our previous analysis suggests this is the answer. So there will be, so let's, so there will be several differences. And let's try to construct a solution and see what it looks like. So the boundary conditions we need to compute, need to use for looking at the decay. So we want a bounce. So that means that the limit in the far future, for a bounce solution in the far future, or the far past, well, in Euclidean time, our solution should look like our initial state, which is the false vacuum. That's not enough in the field theory case. That was the only boundary condition we imposed here in quantum mechanics, we could solve the problem with that boundary condition that in the far past, in the far future, the bound solution reached our false vacuum state. This solution in quantum mechanics was necessarily a finite action. And that's the other property we need to impose in the field theory case. Instantons are saddle points, non-trivial saddle points with finite action. We have an instanton with, or a saddle point with infinite action. It's not going to contribute in the saddle point approximation because e to the minus infinity is zero. So we don't care about saddle points with infinite action. And if we want the action to be finite in this case, we also need to impose that the limit as the other three coordinates go to infinity approach the false vacuum. So this is first condition is so it's a bounce. Second condition is for finite action. Okay. So it can be proved that the lowest action solution is O4 invariant. I won't go through that proof here. It's originally due to Coleman and collaborators, but that greatly simplifies our problem. So we'll just assume that our solutions are O4 invariant, and therefore they're only a function of the radial coordinate. If we go to hyperspherical coordinates. So we can define, so phi bar is only a function of rho, where rho is square root of t squared plus x squared. Okay, so we're looking for saddle points, which means we want to solve the Euclidean equations of motion. And in hyperspherical coordinates, the radial part, which is the only part we care about, is this. So this is the Euclidean equation of motion. And we can solve this equation using intuition from one-dimensional classical mechanics. So if we think about, we interpret rho as a time, then this is just the equation of motion for a particle in a potential with a time-dependent damping force. Okay. And our boundary conditions in these coordinates, these two conditions become a single condition. So our boundary conditions, the limit as rho goes to infinity of phi bar of rho is phi f. We also want for our solution to be non-singular, the derivative of our bounce at with respect to rho at rho equals zero to be zero, so it's non-singular. Okay, so we can interpret these boundary conditions in our analogy with the classical particle. So this second condition is saying that our particle should start at rest. And our first condition is saying that as t goes to infinity, it should end up in the false vacuum. So what we're trying to solve is got a particle moving in a potential minus u, which looks something like this. And our boundary conditions are we can start anywhere as long as it's at rest, and we want to end up at phi f. And so, well, these are unusual boundary conditions for classical mechanics. So it may not be clear whether or not a solution always exists. I'll just present a simple argument that shows that there always is a solution to these boundary conditions. And so we can imagine, in addition to phi f and phi t, I've labeled the position phi star on this graph. And we can imagine what would happen if we started our particle to the left of phi star. Well, there's a damping force which will cause it to lose energy, and it already didn't have enough energy to reach phi f, so it's not going to make it. It's going to go part way up and then come back down. So that's called an undershooting solution. Start to the left of phi star. Now, what happens, you can imagine the opposite case, where instead of starting over here, we start as close as possible to phi t. If we start really close to phi t, then the gradient, the potential is very, very small there, so the particle is going to stay there for a long time. And our damping force is time dependent, and it's decreasing with time. So if we stay near phi t long enough, eventually the damping force will be negligible, and the particle will eventually roll down and overshoot. I'll go past phi f. And by continuity, there has to be a solution in between that starts somewhere between phi star and phi t that ends up at phi f. Okay, so you can imagine a situation where this is violated, and suppose let's suppose it goes to the same value of phi that's as x goes to infinity that's different from phi f. And let's suppose that it approaches a constant. So we can imagine if we're looking at phi and versus x, it does something we don't care about over here, and then it approaches something phi is not equal to phi f. Okay, so something is going on in here. You can neglect it. But for large region, the solution is different from phi f. And so if we look at our equation for the action, these gradient terms will be negligible. And we're integrating a non-zero constant over an infinite volume. So the action will be divergent. And we could I made stronger assumptions than we needed, but this is in presenting a counterexample. So I'm sure there's other counterexamples. Okay. So solution always exists. In general, it's hard to find analytically, and even numerically, these boundary conditions are trickier than usual ones, but it can be done, of course. But there's one limit in which we can understand the approximate form of the bound solutions. And that's if B of phi plus is close to U to U of phi f. In other words, the true and false vacua are approximately degenerate. So in that case, this hill is not very far above zero, and the particle is going to have to stay very close to phi t so that it can wait until the damping term goes away. So if we sketch phi versus rho, it's going to stay near phi t for a long time and eventually roll through the valley and end up asymptotically approaching phi f. And it will cross zero at some radius R naught. So in this case, it's easy to compute the Euclidean action. So, and we can do that by dividing the bound solution into three regions. So there's a region out here where rho is bigger than R naught. In that case, phi f is approximately constant, so the derivative terms don't contribute. And the only term that contributes to our action is this term, but u of phi f is zero. So in that region, there is no contribution to the Euclidean action. On the other hand, in this region for rho less than r naught, again, the bounce is approximately constant. So the only term that contributes is u. And but in this case, u is not going to be 0. So we'll just have the volume of this region, which is 2 minus 2 pi squared r naught. A half pi squared r naught to the fourth times epsilon, where epsilon is u of phi f minus u of phi t. That's the energy density difference between the true and the false vacuum. So this is a volume term. Then the only region we didn't contribute, and this will be a negative contribution to the action because phi t is less than phi f. So epsilon is positive. There should also be a contribution from the small region near R naught. And in the thin wall limit, this is basically just a very thin wall. So it'll be a surface energy or tension term, a surface term. Sorry. And the surface area is 2 pi R naught cubed sigma, where this is a tension of the wall. And here we're just assuming that the wall is very thin. And so if R naught is too big, the wall is going to want to, the bubble is going to want to expand. R naught's too small, the bubble is going to want to contract. And if we want this to be a solution of our Euclidean equation of motions, we should have that the derivative of the Euclidean action with respect to R naught is 0, which tells us that R naught should be 3 sigma over epsilon, and the Euclidean action should be 27 pi squared sigma to the fourth over 2 epsilon cubed. And okay, so let's think for a minute about what our result implies. So we haven't spent a lot of time talking about the functional determinant, the prefactor. And there's a reason, is that at least in many cases, it's completely unimportant. So and why is that? It's not to say it's always unimportant, but for many applications, in particular for vacuum decay, it's unimportant. So here we have SE is some numerical factors, 27 pi squared over 2, which is more than 100. So it doesn't take much of a hierarchy in the scales associated with sigma and epsilon for SE, which appears in the exponent, to be quite large. So SE of 10 to the 3, h bar is not atypical. And, well, that's appearing in the exponent, so e to the minus 10 to the 3. For comparison, the prefactor is going to tell us, it'll provide the dimensions. So this here has a dimension of mass to the fourth in natural units. And if we look at the largest and smallest scales in the universe, say to look at the ratio of the Hubble length, 1 over h naught to the Planck length, that's to the fourth. That's like e to the 560. So if we have e to the minus 1,000, this it doesn't matter what units we use. We can use Planck units or Hubble units. So if S is moderately large, well, 10 to the minus 3, it doesn't matter what units we use for the prefactor. We can use Planck units or Hubble units. That will be a negligible error compared to the accuracy at which we're working.
Why?
Well, if we multiply e to the 560 by e to the minus 1,000, this is, you know, and here, of course, there'd be some uncertainty because we're just working in a fixed center order.
What determines the sigma, the tension?
The tension. So the tension is given by the integral of the potential from phi f to phi t. That you like to think about it, it tells you something about the cost for having a solution that and energy or action that interpolates between the two vacua. So the bigger the barrier, the higher the tension is going to be, roughly. And so the last thing I wanted to say about the decay of the false vacuum is what happens in real time. So to figure out what happens in real time, we can just wick rotate our solution back. Take t, or the Lyapunov time, to minus I t, where t is the time in Minkowski space. And the symmetry of our bound solution is going to change from 04 to 031. And that tells us that the bubble wall, the radius of the bubble wall, will evolve in time. And the radius will be given by t squared plus r naught squared. And so we see that the bubble wall grows in time. So we nucleate a bubble at some time, say t equals 0. And the radius of the bubble will expand. And furthermore, the speed of the wall of the bubble will accelerate and asymptotically approach the speed of light. And to see that, you can note that for t greater than or approximately equal to r naught, dr dt is approximately 1. So it doesn't take long for the bubble wall to accelerate fairly quickly. So that's some probability per unit time and volume to nucleate a bubble. After it nucleates, the bubble walls expand. So we start with some small region of true vacuum, and that region grows with time. And eventually, these bubbles could collide with other bubbles. And if we're just dealing with a fixed space-time background, eventually all of our space-time will decay to the true vacuum.
Yes. Where does this rt equals the square root of t squared plus r naught squared?
So that comes from the fact here that before r naught was squared was equal to rho squared, which was x squared plus t squared. And so if we just analytically continue, this x is what I'm calling r of t. Okay, so I'll begin discussing our next topic. I'll probably have to continue it tomorrow. So the next thing I wanted to discuss is how perturbation theory is related instantons. And so I alluded to a little bit of this yesterday. So you can imagine what we're interested in doing is computing some exact quantity. in quantum mechanics or quantum field theory. This could be an amplitude, an expectation value, something like that, something we expect to be finite. And usually what perturbation theory gives us is an asymptotic series of the form an, g to the n, where g is, say, some small coupling. I'll denote the right-hand side of this, it's phi of g, so this is some formal power series for the quantity of interest. And to recall, an asymptotic series is one in which if we truncate this series at finite, with a finite number of terms, then the asymptotic series becomes a better and better approximation to our original function as we take g to zero. It does not necessarily become a better approximation as we take more and more terms. So a fixed number of terms becomes a better approximation as g goes to zero, but typical examples of asymptotic series are usually diverge. So in fact, they become worse and worse approximations as you take sufficiently many terms. And so the question we're going to ask is, we can go from f of g to phi of g using perturbation theory. Can we go back? So this is divergent. It does contain information about this function, but is there any way to go backwards? And at least sometimes, it seems the answer is yes. And the way we can do this is something called Borel resummation. And we often, although not always, need instanton knowledge about the instantons as well to go backwards. There are examples where you can show that this works, but it's not known, or at least not proven. Although there's some evidence that this works. Generally, it's not proven that you can always do this. And Borel's resummation is an example of the procedures we examined a little bit in the front end. So, and that's summation of a divergent series. So, by summation of a divergent series, I clearly don't mean just adding up all the terms. You get infinity, that's the definition of a divergent series. Summation of a divergent series means defining some well-defined procedure that takes as its input a series or the coefficients of a series and outputs a finite number. That procedure is not just adding up the terms. That would be nonsense. But there are a number of procedures that for large classes of divergent series, you can input the divergent series and output a finite number. And often you can get some information about the original function. I just want to present a brief argument originally due to Dyson for why perturbation series are typically divergent. I'll present it in a slightly different context than his original argument. And so let's consider a particle with a quantum mechanical particle with a potential V of Q, which is Q squared over 2 plus G over 4 Q to the fourth. And the quantity we'll be interested in studying the ground state energy. And so Dyson's argument was basically, if we assume that the perturbation series has a finite radius of convergence, then it has to describe physics for both G positive and G negative. It should be some analytic function in a neighborhood of zero that does that. But if G is positive, then the potential is stable. And the imaginary part of the energy is zero. On the other hand, if G is negative, then the potential is unstable. And the imaginary part is non-zero. So physics is very different in these two cases. So we shouldn't expect a finite radius of convergence. We should expect, rather, a zero radius of convergence, because there's no analytic function that could describe both of these cases. And so that tells us that the divergence, this argument tells us that the divergence of the series, this perturbation series, phi of g, for g greater than zero, is because the potential is unstable for g less than zero. And we've seen that tunneling is a non-perturbative effect. So this argument tells us something more. It tells us that there is a connection between perturbative and non-perturbative physics. And this connection can be made quantitative in some cases. Okay, so question? Yes.
So let me see if I got what you said. So you're saying that the radius of convergence is zero?
Yes.
Because G could go to negative and then the divergence, like the series wouldn't have any sense? Like,
that's right. We can't have a convergence series. So if it has a finite radius of convergence, and we're doing a series expansion around G equals zero, then that series has to converge both for G positive and G negative. The physics is completely different. There's no convergence series that can possibly describe both of these cases. And that tells us, so even if we're only interested in this case, well, this case knows something about this case, because this, divergent series, the series has to be divergent for G positive, and that's because of what happens for G negative. Okay, so I'll say a bit more about this tomorrow, and then we'll move on to discuss the vacuum structure of gauge theories, which will have close analogs with the first problem we looked at there. And so in tutorial today, we'll see another example of this decay of a false vacuum. And lecture is here tomorrow.